Welcome back to season two.
You are now listening to Pillow Talk Radio and Podcast.
This episode, but that was some new radio imaging by yours truly. That's going to be the imaging for season two. And as I had mentioned in the last episode, this season's going to be more based on what war means in a metaphysical way, in a psychological way, spiritually and personally. And I even plan to have some guests that were involved or have been involved or are continued to be involved in the industry of war. But for this episode, I have another very, very special guest.
Special guest star.
It's not all common that you meet a man that's a philosopher, a wanderer, in a very literal sense, a healer. Ladies and gentlemen, on this episode called Krieg, welcome, Porik King.
Hello, friends.
So, Porik, tell us a little blurb about yourself.
Well, I've wandered. I'm trying to heal these days. And I actually got really close to joining the Marines. I don't know if you knew that.
I do.
Yeah. When I was 17, I didn't even think about that until we started talking right now, because I knew we were going to be talking about war, but I didn't even think about it. But it's crazy because my life path could have been so different.
You would have been a different man completely.
Totally. And it's not to say that there's anything bad about that path. It just would have been, it's just so different.
And I think it's, now that you mention it, it's a very interesting point to make, because let's take a quick assessment of what I know about your life. Is that you had you had free reign over your entire 20s in comparison to being in a barrack or being, you know, like being stripped of your identity completely. You had the exact opposite experience. And I think a lot of that is very much what happened in Berlin. You know, like you were around a whole bunch of individuals. You know, even though there was maybe a little less privacy because you lived with a group of individuals, but you also did have the freedom to express who you were, and even when you came back to the United States.
Yeah, definitely. I thought about that a lot, especially while I was in Berlin, because I moved there when I was 20 till I was 22 or so. And I was like, I would think while I'm in, you know, hitchhiking around some country in Europe and at some crazy hippie party or something, mm-hmm. Oh, I'd probably be in Iraq right now, or I'd be back in at base.
Yeah, or at the very least, you'd be back at some beachside dive bar near Pendleton. And I've been to some of those.
Yeah, actually, I've been by Pendleton and met some people there. And it's like, there's still this part of me that's definitely part of me.
Right.
There's something that called out to me, and part of it's just because of the, as I see it more clearly, getting older and looking back, to put it frankly, the manipulation that coming from these recruiters that, you know, they tell you what you want to hear. And
well, they're salesmen.
They definitely are, and like, I totally fell for it because they told me I could be behind enemy lines, learning foreign languages, doing all this cool, you know, secret agent kind of stuff. They made it seem like that. I'm just very lucky my dad had the Because I was 17. If I was 18, I would have just signed the papers and done it because I was so pumped about it. But my dad wouldn't sign the papers because he just made me realize how dumb I basically was.
Yeah.
But yeah, it changed. It's so... It's funny because it's still... There's still some kind of sense of a warrior spirit, but in a very different way of like healing is almost like a war against evil in a sense, or a war against pain or tragedy.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because have you ever read The Art of War?
Mm-mm.
Well, in my edition, at the beginning, the author, I was about to say Arthur, that's for another, another segment.
Freudian slip.
But the author mentioned something in the introduction about, it was an analogy that he compares healing to war. And he says that generals are a lot like healers, and that the best healers know when an illness is about to happen before it even happens. And so they bypass that experience. Next in line are the second best healers that identify an illness and then medicate it. And then third in line is the worst type of healers, which see an illness that it's past its point of medication to where they have to operate. And in the same way, you can say the same thing about effective warriors. Because a good warrior, if you know self-defense, the best type of warrior is someone who can see a conflict happening from a mile away.
Right.
And the worst, theoretically, are the ones that have to go through the thick of battle, so to speak.
Right.
And I want to bring this around to how we actually met, because throughout the week leading up to this episode, I was thinking about the origins of our friendship.
I didn't even think about that.
And the reason why I bring this up in this episode is because we actually met, I believe, in sixth or seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we came together was to play a little game called Command and Conquer.
I totally forgot. That's so funny.
Yes. Yeah, so in a sense, war brought us together.
Mm-hmm. Which is seems to be a common theme of war. I sent you that quote about this because I had recently listened to this podcast about World War I.
Uh-huh.
And one of the commanders there. It's too long of a quote, really, but it's basically saying, like, we need war in our life, or else life is almost pointless. It's like you take the meaning away. Mm. And I think about these people, you know, nowadays, that Marines that'll go out to Afghanistan, and they just are filled with a sense of purpose because they're, even if they don't believe in the cause of the war in the first place, they're there to take care of their brethren.
Yep.
And then they come home and... You know, they're facing hardships and all that, but then they come home and then it's just life is too easy and they get depressed.
Dude, you nailed it. You nailed it, because I think a lot of times we look at things under the scope of bad versus good or good versus evil. And when I was in Scandinavia, you know, obviously like their heritage comes from a lot of Norse beliefs, right? And one of their main gods in their pantheon, Odin. And one of his manifestations is the god of war. And I would think, like, why is this god that is revered a god of war? Like, war is usually a bad thing, or war is usually a very troubling thing. And of course, yeah, it is. But one thing you can say about war is that it brings purpose. Like, that's it. War is simply action.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. Action meets resistance, always. And so that's what makes me want to go into one of the first topics, is why the war impulse?
Yeah. Before I say anything, I just, like, I have all these beliefs about evolutionary psychology and whatnot, and why we're like that, why we're like we are, or why as a sixth grader I would be so compelled by Command and Conquer, as well as paintball. And I would even play with my brothers in the backyard. We didn't even have toy guns. We would just use our fingers and shoot each other and say, bang, and I got you. No, you didn't. And we'd, and,
no, you didn't.
But it was so, it's so embedded in us. I don't even think, I mean, people can say, oh, it's, you're socialized into, but I don't think so. I think there's something that really perhaps it's socialized, but it resonates so strongly. And especially among boys. But I'm no evolutionary psychologist, but just with that caveat, now I'm going to speak freely about what I think about psychology. So, I mean, just thinking about 50-person tribes going around hunting, you know, basically subsisting. If we don't have that warrior spirit, we die off. It's like, I think there's some part that originates from hunting, like almost like a speciesism or something. We're mm-hmm. protecting our species versus mm-hmm. theirs. And then as humans start getting more populous or with agriculture, then we start it's about family. Like there's a saying like, me versus my brother versus my cousin, me and my brother versus my cousin, me and my brother and my cousin versus that other person. And it's like, there's these concentric circles about like yourself first, then your family, then your friends, then your community, your tribe, then your nation, then this human species, then earthlings if there was ever a alien war. So it just seems to be deeply embedded within us and also selected for by you know, female selection.
Well, I did watch this documentary on, I guess, the impending war against extraterrestrials called Independence Day. I'm just kidding. No, but you brought up a good point because, like, you know, my background is in cultural anthropology, and a lot of the things we took into consideration was when we were roaming around in bands and tribes of 20 to 50 people. This was before the pastoral agrarian age. So we would be essentially hunting ecologically naive animals. They'd be like, you know, the bigger versions of animals that we have now. And we'd live pretty high off the hog if we killed one of them mm-hmm. for about, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Well, we fucked that up real bad. And now at that point, we started to realize, like, shit, we don't really have a lot of the same game that we used to have. So now we're going to have to rely on plants. So we domesticate these plants. We develop, we cultivate, you know, what is it called? Why doesn't the name escape me?
Agriculture?
Agriculture, right. And agriculture is pretty sedentary. So we have to protect our our land. And from there, we have borders. And from borders, we have civilization. And then we have power structures, hegemony, and hierarchy. And from there, we have resources. And what happens when you have another civilization that wants your resources? War.
Right.
But I think a lot of the impulse to fight for something comes from the hunter-gatherer mentality. Mm-hmm. So you do have a point there.
I'm actually not sure, and it's more of a question really, is it coming from the hunting part, or is it coming from human-to-human?
I think human-to-human.
Or even just, even within a tribe, males vying for the female, you know, because one male can inseminate multiple females, and so they say there's twice as many female ancestors than there are male ancestors because one male will win out over several other ones, you know, passing their seed along, while a lot of the males that are just weaker and not as aggressive or not as fit will just, that will be the end of their bloodline right there. And so so we naturally select for a more aggressive, and it makes sense. Men are just on every, I mean, there are some women that are more aggressive than the average man, but for the most part, the most aggressive crimes and actions are all by men.
Testosterone, yeah.
Right.
And that's probably been selected for, too. I mean, sexual dimorphism, which is, you know, the difference between sexual traits between the sexes in any animal or most animals, is, you know, happens for a reason. You know, the woman is, except for maybe bonobos and some other things, but usually the male is a dominant animal. Strength-wise, you know, it's...
Right.
I mean, it goes down to symbolism, too. Like, you look at an erect penis, you know, it's an active member. Mm-hmm. It's like a muscle shooting straight out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of symbolic of male nature.
Yeah.
And what about unhealthy outlets?
Yeah, so I guess the idea we have this impulse in us, and so it can, what do we do in 2018 when we're not actually hunting for food in the forest, or our tribes, we don't have the fear of some marauding tribal people coming to invade our village and pillage everything.
I guess so, we have sports.
We got sports. Yeah, I used to be so against, I used to just think it was so stupid, like how many billions of dollars and effort are put into sports.
I still think it's a little stupid, to be honest. I mean, dude, like, multi-millions, like, that's too much.
Yeah, there's a part of me that thinks if we were to focus that energy, like the World Cup, for instance, even just that, like the effort, the amount of manpower and money, just put it towards some cause, like, it could be anything, really. But I think that's a kind of a limited view. It doesn't take human nature into account because there's obviously a reason that it's there. And it's like, if we don't have that outlet. I was actually listening to a podcast today, and what were they saying? They were saying something like, and it was just someone's opinion, really, but that if their prediction, and I'm not even saying that I agree with this, but I found it an interesting thought, that if porn was... they're saying that porn in India is today illegal and also like not really watched, and there's a higher percentage of like misogyny or rapes.
Dude,
or
there's some
sexual
bad
acts.
Rape cases over there.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't really know the statistics, but it's just an interesting thought that
they're probably sexually frustrated. I'm not trying to excuse that.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm just like, they're probably,
and so what the person postulated that I heard today was saying, if porn were to be legal, that they predicted that the rape rate and you know, attacks on women would go down. And I don't know. It's an interesting thing to ponder, at least. But that being said, along that same line of thinking, video games, war games, sports, those kind of things. If they didn't exist, if you were to like snap your finger and tomorrow all those things are gone, what would our society look like, given that we still have those impulses deeply embedded within us?
I had never considered that, because like, it's true. Like, you look at a lot of the things that we channel our energy into, and sexual energy is a thing. You know, I mean, it's an essential drive within us to procreate. You know, like, for example, let's say I'm horny right now. Well, usually there's a few things I can do in private about that kind of a thing, or I can just quote unquote find a chick to have sex with. Well, it's not as easy as it sounds. And if it's not as easy as it sounds and I have no other outlet, what else am I going to do aside from lift weights or go to the gym or do something athletic? Same thing. You can't really do that for too many hours of the day because your body is going to wear out. I mean, so what, you're going to work a job and then go play tennis for 5 hours, that's not really reasonable. And what happens when you go watch TV? I mean, like, there has to be an outlet. You're absolutely right. I mean, you make a good point.
Yeah, and it's really just a thought experiment, because obviously we couldn't test something like that.
No.
But
at least not at a large scale.
Right, and I, my personal feeling about when I see games like Grand Theft Auto is as fun as it is and as addicted to it that I was, because I used to play all kinds of video games, especially first-person shooters, killing people and stuff. My thought is that's so aggressive and so, I mean, it's horrible. Like Grand Theft Auto is really one of the most degenerate games you can think of. It's just like, you're just killing people, stealing their cars, just causing mayhem. But I know they've done studies and that don't correlate any increase in violent behavior with people that play those kind of games. So, and I almost wonder if it's a good outlet or something. But I do think even beyond that, I think we need some kind of outlet. And I don't think that that's the best choice. But I think, you know, fighting for a cause of some kind, finding your war, whatever it may be. But I do see that, maybe not used in the violent sense, but people, well, I have this interesting experience that kind of shifted my thinking on a lot of things. I used to be vegetarian for a while, and so I went to this protest for a circus protesting the animals' use in the circus, like the elephants at a Barnum and Bailey's thing. And I was there to support the protesters, to go along with them, and more to view it, not to like really yell at people. But I saw that they were definitely warriors. They had a cause, and they even used warlike terms. They were saying, whose side are you on? And like, what's your... And they saw that I was just taking pictures and not holding signs. And so when I told them, when they saw that I came with a certain person, they were like, oh, okay, you're on my side. And so, and they mentioned my camera as a, they used, the terms they used was like, it's, oh, that's your weapon of choice. And I thought it was very interesting, the war terminology they used for being, you know, at least ostensibly peacekeepers or promoting nonviolence against animals especially.
And that's one of the interesting things too, is like, I don't know, I kind of have a problem against those that claim themselves to be peacekeepers when they actually make war. And I feel like it's more respectable to be a warrior and speak about making peace, because sometimes the only way you can reach peace is via war. Mm-hmm. For example, let's see how it manifests in relationships. Well, let's say you have a friend, or you have a close friend, or you have a girlfriend, and there's something that the other individual is doing that bothers you. Sure, you can repress that to quote-unquote keep the peace. But sometimes you need conflict in order to really hash things out.
Right.
That's why they say, you know, like, maybe not constant fighting in a relationship. You know, maybe not fighting once every week or every few days. But maybe once every 3-4 weeks, having an argument or having a debate is actually quite healthy, because it hashes things out. War can be healthy in that way. Hopefully in the future it doesn't get to the point where we lose a lot of men and women. But it is necessary. My problem is with the people who claim to have peaceful intentions but use that as a reason to create mayhem unnecessarily.
Right. That's interesting. That goes back to that Tolstoy's point about the good warrior, the best version, I guess, of those three types that you talked about earlier, that having conflict, hashing it out ahead of time or as it comes, would be the best solution. But back to people that, you know, hide behind the veil of peace or, you know, pacifism. I think that's more dangerous than someone who's just outright honest about, you know, I hate this or fuck these people or whatever.
Right.
Because at least they're honest. And my fear is, and I've heard this said when I was young, and I've always believed it, like, the people who you should really watch out for who are the most dangerous are the people who are convinced they're doing good. And those are the scariest ones, because, you know, I think... Yeah, In Christian terms, we're kind of all sinners, meaning that, you know, we're not perfectly good people. We all have this dark side. And that's really why I like the degenerate kind of mentality that you talk about, that I haven't actually been able to. I talk about it sometimes to people, and I can't actually articulate it as as well as you do. But I do think it's important, because, you know, when people are convinced that they're all good, then it's like, then it's kind of scary, because those are the people that... often, and I saw this with those very people I was at the protest with. I came there not with the intention to, I ended up writing a blog about them, and they were so mad. They sent me all this hate mail afterwards.
Oh my God.
And I wasn't hating on them. I was just observing what I didn't set out to write a bad thing about them. I just came to support them, and then I realized, wow, I came to a realization when I saw that they were just saying the most hateful things to these people that were, that people were more ignorant about it. I didn't think they were like evil people. Mm-hmm. They were just taking their kids to the circus because they're trying to be good parents and they want to show their kids a cool
thing.
Their
intentions were good.
Right.
Right.
And they were just saying, you don't deserve to be parents. You're horrible people. Like, basically, like, it's kind of the worst thing you could say to someone. It's like, you don't deserve to be a parent. Like, your bloodline, your lineage should stop now. That's almost like the biggest insult you could say.
That's dehumanizing in a way. Yeah,
it's
that's
the most intense thing you could say to someone.
And what you're saying, it's beginning to make me think about these types of individuals. Like, I met a guy about a month ago. He said that he came back from the Bay Area. He was living in Berkeley, and he said that at this point, because I haven't been there in a few years, he says, dude, in the past couple years, like, what are they called? Antifa?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They are running shit over there now. Like, it's Like, the whole, like, did you just assume my gender thing is a real fucking day-to-day occurrence over there, right? And he says, like, whenever there's a Trump thing that's going on, these Antifa guys will go out with their batons and start smashing up cars.
Right.
Well, these people claiming peace is essentially, and like the people that you're talking about as well, that's the social equivalent of passive aggression, I think. It's like someone who really wants to get something across, but isn't big enough to admit what they're really trying to do. They're really just trying to hide behind the veil of being a nice person, but using that as an excuse to do wrong because they feel like their group and their maybe ideology is truly powerless. I'm not saying it is powerless, but I'm just saying that's...
Right. Yeah, I think there's some... It's interesting because I've met so many people that I go around and I talk to all kinds of people. So I'll talk to the most right-wing people, I'll also talk to the most left-wing people. And I feel like people who are, it's usually a psychological thing about them rather than the cause itself as being, you know, because I do align with what Antifa's trying to do. It's like, yeah, fuck Nazis for sure. But often it's, they have some psychological maybe lack that they're trying to fill or trying to virtue signal to other people, like, see how good I am. And so I think that's, yeah, it's an example of that war spirit, the warrior spirit that just kind of, it needs to find an outlet somewhere, and those kind of people probably don't play video games or play sports. And maybe I'm totally wrong about them, but I don't really see that. And so it's got to go somewhere. And the problem with it is, like, with video games, it's like there's a humility attached to it. You don't think you're saving the world. You know you're just some guy playing video games in your basement or whatever. Whereas with that, they think they're saving the world.
Right.
And that's really the danger in it because...
Well, there's a delusion there.
Yeah, there's a delusion and a hubris.
Hubris indeed. So, that being said, with these unhealthy outlets, what would you say would be a better way to wage war?
Yeah, so I found it interesting, this, and I'll credit where I've heard it from. I've listened to a lot of Jordan Peterson, and he's a very controversial figure these days, but I found it very interesting, this concept he talked about rats that fight each other, that if there's a rat that's much bigger than another rat and they're playing rough and tumble, just like wrestling with each other, kind of like how dogs do, that if the bigger rat keeps winning, the other rat just won't play. And so the rat kind of has to let you win, and or else it'll be stuck not being able to play with anyone because he wins too much. And that's not to say you shouldn't be your best or do your best, but I see it as like a war is as a series of battles. So like you can easily crush someone in the first battle, but then if you use all your ammunition in the first round, then no one's going to want to play with you. So that's just, and that can be used in any way, whether you're Antifa or whether you're, you know, just someone trying to live your regular life, I guess. But I think about, like, I was doing jiu-jitsu the other day at school, and there's this guy there he's just trying so hard to make everyone know that he's like the best, and he's probably not. I mean, he's okay, he's been doing it for a while, but he's just obviously not good. And we're just drilling moves, and the idea is not to like totally hurt someone, it's just to like practice moves, and he's in there just going so hard and like trying to hurt you. And it's, so for me, I'm just looking at him, I'm just like, I'm just not gonna play with you anymore. And in a way he's losing, and I feel like if you wanna win in life kind of, or like get by, like you have to play in such a way that people will want to keep playing with you. And so it's, so you can say the most, like I can, with everyone I can say something that I think is totally bad about them, because everyone has it, And if I just said that right away, no one would ever want to talk to me, right? But if I want to really make an effect in someone's life, I understand, I hear them, I understand them, I'll play on in such a way that they'll want to play with me. And by play, I just mean talk, engage. And then when I do say some kind of criticism, it'll be taken rather than just immediately going to war. And that's just like, whatever, a tip for effectiveness in war.
Yeah, what you said made me realize that unlike rats, because it seemed like you were kind of going into like this big rat, small rat thing with like, you didn't want to mess with this guy because like he's just going to be a jerk, right? But it made me realize that unlike many animals at least, or if not most or all animals, humanity is multidimensional and non-binary. I don't want to use non-binary like some politically correct thing. What I want to say is rats and other animals like that tend to be binary and one-dimensional in scope. Like, there is domination and submission. Mm-hmm. There is kill or be killed and mate or not mate. You know, like, human beings with cultures like ours, we have martial arts, we have the arts, we have sciences and maths, we have academia, we have corporate culture, we have subcultures and co-cultures. And this individual may be dominant in the sphere of local martial arts, but maybe he compensates for his complete inability to relate to his own family. And maybe he is seen as a black sheep. And that's actually the way that I see a lot of individuals who are actually snobbish in some field or domain, is I feel like they condescend on other people who don't have their similar taste because they subconsciously see whatever domain they feel like they have authority over as a way to express whatever power, however small they have, over something. And they hold that over others. And it makes me realize that a lot of the war that should be of a pinnacle focus is the war within.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's just say this individual, I mean, because I don't think really many healthy people will try to specifically hurt others.
Right. It seems to be the most insecure people are the ones who will pull you down, and the most secure and most, you know, in touch with themselves or confident, they'll lift you up.
But what is insecurity but a war within?
Right.
It's the instability. It's a constant battle being waged inside of ourselves. And my opinion is men, from my experience, tend to be more insecure than women. And I'm not saying that as like a dig towards men, but if you look at like the archetypal symbols of the yin and yang, there is weakness within strength and strength within weakness. So actually the strongest people I know are women. I mean, you look at people like women who can get over like debilitating divorces, severe family tragedies. Like, women are the ones that usually come on top, and men are usually the ones that are broken. And even in breakups, I've seen a lot of men play it off like they're really cool, but in reality, they start to develop either drug or drinking habits, reckless behaviors, violent tendencies. And it's because men tend to not deal with emotions better. And a lot of it's rooted in insecurity that I don't think is entirely culturally shaped. I think that that is also like an attribute of like a hunter warrior mentality, because you can't really just cry on the battlefield.
Right. And I think it also kind of goes back to what we're saying about the selection process, that there is an insecurity, because if you don't compete well, or there's the end of your lineage right there.
Exactly.
So there's good reason to be insecure, really, because even though it's kind of a vestige of our, because nowadays the reality is there's so many women out there. If you really want to, you'll find a mate. Whereas back then, if you didn't, you know, there's only actually maybe three or four viable mates in a 50-person thing when you take away the elderly and the children and the ones who already have mates. It's like there's maybe three or four options, and if you fuck it up, then that's the end of your lineage right there. Especially if there's like way cooler guys, so it's
cooler. But yeah, like, so but he brought up a good point, like the whole like competing thing. I think there is definitely a fine line. Like, there needs to be some sort of insecurity or penis envy in order to compete well, because you need to be on your toes, because, you know, like, you need to be able to fuck the bitch. Excuse me, my language. For any ladies listening, you need to be able to, like, hunt that elk or whatever. You know, like, you need to be on your toes, because there's going to be, like, another guy in, like, a competing tribe that's going to make you feel like shit. And you need to feel like a little like shit in order to be able to, like, be on your toes and throw that spear faster, because your lineage depends on it, and so does your tribe. Yeah. So that's what I actually kind of pisses me off about when I hear a lot of, like, politically correct women and feminists talk about the fragile male ego, because I don't think they completely understand where it may come from. And I think they believe that it's something that we can just control like that. And I don't know, I think it's a bit more complicated than just saying that men are big babies.
Right. Yeah. So back to the more effective warrior strategies, I suppose, especially in the context of modern day, when we're not actually fighting for our lives, kind of thing. In a sense, we are, for livelihood. But yeah, I've been liking more and more, and historically I used to just kind of be really turned off by religious ideas, but this idea of, like, Jesus as the greatest warrior, at least in Western culture, in a sense, he's not like Muhammad, where he's leading battalions into battle kind of thing, but more of like a warrior of peace kind of thing.
Is this like the way you perceive him, or is that the way you like read about him? Or
yeah, I've heard. I mean, I couldn't claim that. I don't know enough about the Bible to really like speak.
But this is like your perspective.
This is my perspective now, based on scholars. I listen to different podcasts. So like lately, I've been listening to lots of religious podcasts, and I find this quote interesting: that the meek will inherit the earth thing. That's largely said. And I've heard it translated in a different way, that because meek usually means someone who's timid,
right?
Someone who's and that would I would more equate with pacifism kind of thing. But I've heard that the translation is actually a little bit different. Like when you would actually translate it from the Greek, or I think it was in originally, that it's more like saying someone who meek would it wouldn't mean meek, but it would mean someone who has a sword but keeps that sword sheathed. So it's basically
self-controlled
and with the implicit ability and knowledge that they have the ability to wage war if necessary.
So someone who speaks softly but carries a long
basically
stick.
Yeah. And I see the power in that. It's kind of like we talked about the best kind of warrior that Tolstoy talks about, someone who will wage war early on when necessary kind of thing. And you know, I also mentioned to you before we started recording here about this screensaver I had as a kid on the computer that said, like, pacifism is the parasite of freedom. Pacifists are the parasite of freedom. Parasites. And I thought that I didn't really understand it as a kid, but it's basically people who are going to stand back and say, like, I'm peace. They're going to let the people that are just wholly aggressive just take over. And so in a way they're parasites of freedom, because they're not standing up for what's right. And it's like, so the Jesus figure is like it, just purely seen in a metaphorical sense, not necessarily having to believe in any divinity or anything like that. He's just someone who basically is uplifting everyone else and just spreading peace and like healing, and that's kind of your war, and you're warring against evil spirits. I don't know if you ever read this, the Screwtape Letters, or heard about it.
I've heard of it, but I've never read it.
I find it so fascinating. It's just basically, it's really cleverly written. It's a C.S. Lewis thing about, you would actually really like it, knowing like how you talk about demons and stuff, but it's basically a demon talking to his nephew, saying, giving him advice at how to better manipulate the humans. And basically, reading that book was actually very revelatory to me. Whether you end up believing in demons or not, even if you're just looking at it in a purely metaphorical way, just we're constantly battling demons. It's basically every temptation into doing the less good choice. So it's like if someone in your class is better than you or something, you can either put them down or you can, you know, lift them up and be humble in front of them and learn from them. And that would be the better war strategy, because in the end you lift them up and you go along with them, like the tide that rises all boats kind of idea, as opposed to putting them down so that you're relatively higher than them, which is like a more shallow war strategy.
You know, it seems like that brings up what we were discussing before about the insecurity that comes with the hunter instinct, you know, to compete. It seems like that is an evolution, that's an evolutionary skill that we must attain in order to tame that instinct from our past. Because, you know, like they say that stress is kind of like this evolutionary residue of, like, you know, times where we had to be stressed for our lives because we never knew if there's a predator near right. ourselves. Well, perhaps that insecurity or that instinct to put someone else down for our personal gain should also be, is also in the process of being tamed by these parables in order to, like, benefit society rather than our own personal tribes or our own personal DNA.
What parables do you
mean? Well, I mean, like, the parable you just told me.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm not sure I understood that.
For example, okay, so I'm comparing stress to, like, a necessary response to, let's just say, living in prehistoric times,
mm-hmm.
to where we had a, like,
fight or flight,
yeah. And the insecurity that comes from our needing to be that 1 foot forward among other men in order to secure resources for our tribe is also still present in our society right now.
Right.
But we have parables from the Bible and from, like, written mm-hmm. works like C.S. Lewis
yeah.
in order to tame that insecurity or that right. need to be better than.
Right. In a way, it's kind of, it's so interesting. The Bible's written after the agricultural revolution, so it's not written by hunter-gatherers. So it's, mm-hmm. it, but it seems to be taking into account this instinct that we have, and obviously
like
not
Old
knowing.
Testament.
Yeah, and obviously didn't know about evolution at the time, but it definitely right. recognizes those instincts. And so it is a great way, I think, the more I look at it, the more I see the value in it, that it's a great way to tame, and especially it's even applicable to nowadays. We're not, just like stress is, we're stressed about a test or something, but we really, it's so bad for our health to be chronically stressed, mm-hmm. and it's not like we're going to die. Stress is useful only if you're going to die.
It's not like we're going to die. But do you know what I'm saying with that?
Right.
Like, I mean, it's a very simple thing. Like, it's almost like we get stressed about these things as if it is literally life or death.
Mm-hmm.
But life or death scenarios aren't common anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless we get, God forbid, knock on wood, into a car accident.
Sure, yeah.
But otherwise, there's no reason, theoretically, to stress that much over a test.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is definitely a reason to be concerned in order to perform well, in order
sure.
to, you know.
And in the same way, there's no reason to be putting other people down because your lineage, your bloodline is not at risk as it was
exactly.
thousands of years ago.
And then we could still secure some sort of resources in order to provide for
right.
said family or said
right.
lineage. So I see that we've deconstructed war to a pretty industry degree. So for the listeners, let's unwind a little bit as we come near the close of this podcast. So tell us, what are you drinking right now, Pork?
I am in Rome, So therefore, I'm drinking, as all the Romans do, Old English brand 800. What does the 800 actually mean?
It's a random number, I guess. Make it seem more intense in the hundreds.
Yeah, it's like every... I mean, I know Steel Reserve has 211.
Yeah.
It's got to have its number, right?
Look at how, like, minimal this graphic is.
Yeah, it's very like, simple. And I like it has the cold when blue. It's like, you can't just feel it to see if it's cold. You got to have something that tells you if it's cold or not.
Yeah, that's...
But cool. This is my first Old English I've ever...
Yeah,
drunken.
For the listeners, I mean, I'm
7.5%? I had no idea. Didn't taste like it.
Yeah, for like 95% of you who listen to this, you probably know Porik firsthand. But
all six of you.
All six of you.
So five of you know me.
Yeah, all three of you. Yeah, Joel does. Joel, shout out to Joel. Joel is the only person that doesn't know Porik. And Porik, you actually don't drink. You don't go to war with a lot of alcohol.
No. Lately, I've been drinking more, and I've told you I'm in a situation in my life where people care if I smoke weed or not, so...
Yeah, but that used to be your main thing of choice. Oh, by the way, I've been doing a lot more acid. Well, I mean, not a lot more, but more than I had when you were around here, and it's been pretty cool, so...
Yeah, I feel like we missed out, because at that time, I was doing the weed and the acid stuff.
I know.
And now we're switch roles.
So, tell me... What does the word Arthur mean to you?
Oh, gosh. Is Arthur going to ever hear this podcast? That's the... It honestly, it's probably one of the scariest words in the English dictionary this point.
Explain why.
I actually had... And my dreams have been very revelatory recently. So it must have been a couple months ago, maybe 6 months ago even. I'm not sure exactly when it was, the dream. But... Well, I'm not sure I want to say it. I have this... See, this is how deeply instilled this fear of the word Arthur is. That I don't even know if I want to say anything, because it'll... I'm actually afraid to post anything online to reveal where I live these days.
Because he'll show up.
I just feel like he'll show up at my door any day.
Dude, it's true. He does... Okay, so... Give us a little bit more about who Arthur is, so I can explain how true what you just said is.
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start. One of the first things that pops into my mind always when I think about him is, and it's something I didn't even experience, but Jake V experienced, where he gets a call in the middle of the night, and this is very typical, 3 a.m, say, and it's Arthur on the other line. Come outside right now. He's like, what? Come outside right now. And so he's like, what the fuck? Come out right now. And it's like, okay, I'm coming. And you go outside, and Arthur's standing in the middle of the street with gasoline poured onto the street. And then he lights a match and lights up gasoline.
That
right
happened?
Yeah. And then gets back in his car and just drives away. And just after this flaming...
Like this mini inferno. Okay, so similarly, tell them about that time with the passport.
Passport?
Okay, this was when he was living with you guys, right? Didn't he show up one night and didn't he just walk into, it might have been Joe's room. Walks into Joe's room with a passport and a wad of cash with a random girl. You don't remember
that? I have no recollection of that, but that doesn't sound... See, the thing about it is I'm never surprised anymore, because the fact that... Was it his passport or just some random person's passport?
No, apparently it was his. Okay, so he showed up, and I think it was probably Joe then. He shows up and goes to Joe's room, and he just shows up with a random chick, a passport and a wad of cash, and starts laughing hysterically, then walks out.
Yeah, well, something I will say, despite anything negative I could say about him, I actually still feel a deep love for him. He was my best friend for years, really.
That's what I want you to get towards.
And I feel like he really changed my life in a positive way, where he...
Get to that.
The main thing is, basically he said, like, okay, here's life. Here's all the rules, the unwritten rules that we all follow.
Now,
and we don't really think
those
about
rules.
Yeah, basically, they actually don't need to be followed. And look, watch, I'll break this rule right here. And like, oh, see, we broke it, and we're still alive, and we're still here. And it's like, and that was the biggest epiphany of my life. Wow, you can just break those rules. And there's some rules that if you break, the consequences are severe enough where it's not worth it. But there's lots of other rules. Mostly, what I gained, learned from him, I would say, is the social rules, because those ones have the consequences are kind of like those vestiges of stress, where we fear not being accepted by people, because if we're in this 50-person tribe and we're rejected, that might mean our death, because if we're rejected from the tribe, then we can't survive on our own. But now we're in a world where, you know, if someone doesn't like us, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
So basically, it's go up to someone and tell them exactly how you feel, or ask them the most out there question, but that's interesting and or meaningful. And we would have the most interesting conversations and the most interesting experience. We'd go out. It would be a Tuesday night. I'm in, you know, senior year of high school, and, you know, ready for school in the morning. I have to wake up at 7, and he'd show up at 2 in the morning and say, come outside right now. And I'm like, Arthur, I have school in the morning. He's like, come outside right now. And I go, okay. Because I know it's going to be something interesting. And we just go out, drive to L.A., meet the most random people, get them in the car, like, hey, come with us. And then we'd go drive to some random place, sneak up on some rooftop, and have some really interesting conversation with someone. And it's just, it's like life is a big video game, and he knows the cheat codes to break outside of the rules. And that, if anything, taught me I utilized the lessons I learned from him in day-to-day, because even before we started this, I was just talking about how I've kind of cultivated this side of me, which Arthur definitely introduced me to, but it's part of me now. But I go out and I just talk to people, and there's these social norms like, oh, you don't know that person, you can't just go up and talk to them. But no, I'll just go up and say, hi, how are you, or whatever, and you know, I'm not outlandish or...
And that's why I brought this up, because Arthur and his actions, there's an implication of action and conflict all the time with Arthur. I think these are two of the very few pillars of what war is. What exactly did Arthur wage war against?
The status quo.
The status quo.
Norms. He basically saw life, and he's like, I don't know if he ever said this outright, but it's the most magnificent miracle that we're born and we have minds and we have bodies and we can move them as we will. And then there's all these social norms that are just, in a sense, enslaving us to just say, oh, hi, over there, and don't talk to that person. You can't look them in the eyes for too long. You can't do this. You can't say that. You can only do these kinds of things. And he's just like, we are infinitely more than that. And so I think he waged war against and I feel like he's losing, sadly. Because I wish he's definitely won battles,
many battles.
And it's interesting to think back to talking about the rat, the big rat and the small rat. It's not necessarily a dominance and a submissive kind of thing, but he's definitely played the game of, I'm going to do what I want because fuck the system, fuck the rules, fuck all the norms. We should live how we want. But then he'll break these norms that, you know, I feel like I'm open-minded, and especially to him, I'm probably the most tolerant of him than any of our friends, really.
So true.
And I've still reached my limit where I've blocked him because, you know, he wants to hang out with me, and instead of just a normal person might be like, hey, you want to hang out? Oh, no, you're busy. And then get a signal or something. Oh, they're busy, so I won't hang out. If he wants to hang out, he will keep calling me
right
over and over and over and over and over until I, you know, hang out with him. Or he'll borrow something. This is more in the past because I wouldn't let him borrow anything now, but borrow a bike or something or a skateboard. And they'll be like, hey, dude, where's my skateboard? It's been a week. He's like, oh, well, I gave it to some guy. And I'm like, well, dude, that's my board. And like, he's like, well, it's just a material thing. Don't be attached to it.
But it's almost to the point where I remember him waging so much war, so to speak, that one time, I think he might have been with you or one of our other friends, and he was telling... this is when I had saved a lot of money to go abroad, and I guess someone had told him that. And so he called me up, and all he said was, hey, give me $1,000 for a computer. And I hung up the phone on him because I knew that he wanted to go against his own fear of asking for someone for money. And these are kind of like the battles he loses, but these are still the battles he wages.
Right. And he's won.
Yeah,
so
he's
many
won.
Times. He's done amazing things with his life. He's jumped out of helicopters in Norway. And
oh, no, but this is after him being homeless, too.
Right.
Like, this is like he just somehow, he managed to do all these things, like incredible feats that seemed impossible. Some of the things, I mean, I still do believe him on a lot of, he says a lot of the stuff that he's done, a lot of people don't believe him. But I actually believe him.
Yeah.
Because his capacity to pull those things off.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to ask you is, because of what you said earlier about the things he's taught you, going back and realizing that about 1.6, I believe it was either 1.6 to 3 million years ago, far, far into like the hominin past, mankind developed a tool industry called the Oldowan tool industry. And it was a series of very basic choppers used to chop meat. Fast forward to about 1 million years later, we have the Acheulean tool industry, which looks a bit more pointed, a bit less blocky, up to the Mousterians, up until the very Clovis Point period, 10,000 years ago, along the western side of North America, where we start to get the basic shapes for arrowheads. We see that hunting has prompted development and technology. So has war.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say the war that Arthur has taught you has given you any form of symbolic technology?
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I really think it's changed my life for the better. Because fortunately for me, and in a way unfortunately for him, he was kind of the scapegoat. He was kind of, he went out and ventured out, and he kind of forged the path, but also took all the heat, or took all the...
Yeah, he was on the front lines.
He was on the front lines, and I came behind him, and I learned what to do and what not to do. But I learned basically how to break, and it served me, and break social norms. And it has served me in, you know, when I was in high school, I kind of learned how to rig the system in a way to become, I was senior class president, and I didn't really give a shit about all that kind of stuff, but I just knew exactly the kind of things to say and social norms to break and what triggers to pull and which ones not to, and to make that thing, it just made life fun.
Right.
And it wasn't like I'm trying to get a scholarship to UCLA, so I'm going to be like ASB. It was more just like I want to like have fun and like fuck around with the system. And I was describing to you earlier, I'm kind of doing the same thing. Or even just like I played this show recently I was telling you about. And it was, and I think because of things that I've learned from Arthur, it's like I knew how to just like cut through the basic social... whatever it is, just people have this way of the, and I just say like, whoa, cut right through all that and just, hey everyone, here I am. I'm not sure that makes sense because we're going off of a context I told you, but basically it was about me playing this show the other night, an open mic kind of thing where everyone was talking and I basically was able to get the whole place to be quiet and listen, and it turned out being like a really meaningful time to play music.
Well, isn't that just a tactic?
Yeah, definitely, it's a tactic. And it's... I feel like I've got the best part of what Arthur has to offer, or what he's taught me. And I also know where the limits are. I know how to break them, but I also know that in the long term, to win the overall war, as far as he knows how to win every battle, but he's also the rat that'll dominate too hard and no one wants to play with him anymore. And that's what's happened. No one wants to play with him anymore, unfortunately. And I feel bad for him. And I'm one of those people that don't want to play with him anymore. And by play, I just mean interact or engage. And I've seen, okay, those are the limits you can go to. You can break any limit you want, but if you want to be part of society or part of community, then here's the limits that aren't actually real, but they're real in the sense that they, if you follow them, they'll lead to, you know, advancing this or...
Well, then, at that point, what you're describing is, and again, like, I actually have no beef with Arthur. I actually really like the guy. I find him to be a...
I love him.
I find him to be like a rare jewel of a friend, but it's just there comes a point where some behavior can be antisocial. And I'm not saying he's a very social man, but I meant psychologically antisocial, where if things go against society too much, society will prevail.
Yeah.
I mean, the mass of society will prevail. Look at the Nazi Party. If you go against society and civilization, if you try to exterminate something, these bodies of government, these nation states, will be corrected by the greater whole of humanity. Right. And that's usually the case. Similarly, Arthur is one that goes a lot against social norms. And though he is, one of his strengths is to bend the status quo to his will, humanity eventually prevails over him.
Yeah.
And that's why, this drink is dedicated to Arthur, wherever you are. You're a fucking...
I'll drink to Arthur.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad, really, because I just think he's really a beautiful person who has so much to offer the world, and the world's just not ready for him. And maybe in some future date when, you know, because seeing how technology is going... And there might be a point in our future where there's kind of an ultra transparency, if you can start reading each other's thoughts, kind of thing. That the way that Arthur is would be
he's already been there.
Would be the norm, and he might be living 50 years, 100 years ahead.
Dude,
in the
it's
future.
So true. I remember meeting Arthur. Dude, the first time I got to know Arthur was when I was around 19, 20 years old, and I couldn't take him because at that point I was going through a lot in life and I was extremely insecure. It wasn't until like 2 or 3 years later that I was able to actually bear being around him and actually became a friend. And it's because Arthur was so transparent. Also, he has this really weird intuitive gift to where he can sniff out things in your psyche. You notice that?
Oh, yeah. He's very intuitive.
Yeah. It used to be unnerving for me.
Right.
Until I started like shooting it back towards him or like started shooting up like an opaque persona. I don't know. It was weird. But it used to be really bad.
Go on.
speaking of intuitive, I remember one time he didn't have a place to stay, so he stayed at my house for a couple nights when I was 22, my family's house. He manipulated his way to stay. And the next day I was going to pick up an SP-404, I believe. I think that's what it was called. It was a sampler. I was going to Echo Park. I didn't have a car at the time, so I was taking the bus. And he was like, hey, I'm going to come with you. I was like, all right, well, just don't talk a lot. So he came along. And by the time we got to downtown L.A., where I had to transfer from Whittier, I had grown weary of him. Because he would talk incessantly of like just like being in the present, which is one of his great strengths. He's one of the most in tune and present people I've ever met. But he wouldn't shut up. And so like I remember I got off the bus, I ran around the block, I went somewhere, he was just nowhere to be found, hopped on the bus I needed to get to, got to Echo Park, got off on Sunset. I'm walking for a minute and I feel something sneering at the back of my neck, and I look behind me. And in rush hour traffic, I see Arthur Lopez walking in the middle of Sunset Boulevard, in the median, with his arms spread out in a Christ pose. He found me. Arthur Lopez found me when I had ditched him miles away.
Christ found you. A lost soul wanderer.
So I think I ran away again. I literally ran away from him twice that day. And I'm not talking about just running on foot. Like, I like got off the bus when I knew he wasn't going to be behind me. And he stayed on the bus. And he found me twice. That's Arthur Lopez.
Pretty typical story.
Yeah. I mean, like you had mentioned, that like how you started off this segment on Arthur Lopez with Jake V, it's really nothing uncommon. I can't even imagine all the other shit he's done.
Right.
In the times that I have not been around him, which is 99.99% of his life.
Right.
But with that being said, Pork, what more would you like to say about your sense of war? What does war look like within you? And I'm not asking for your deepest, darkest secrets, but what war do you face at a daily level?
Yeah, I think I definitely am fighting war against, along the vein of kind of going off of Arthur, I think my time with him has set me on a path of, and I think actually the reason I resonated with him to become friends with him was because I was already on this path in a way. But there's so many social norms and things that I just feel like I need to break, and not enough people are brave enough to wage that war. And when I see society nowadays going into, like the person that sat next to me on the plane that was just today on the way over here, just didn't want to interact, just looking at their phone and was all mad because I didn't get out of the seat fast enough so they can go stand in line just to get off the plane, and you know, you have to stand there anyway. It's like this disconnect, and I'm just feeling like I always get these intimations that life is just so beautiful and awesome and all those great things, and people are just losing it. Like, they're just watching TV, getting jaded by this and that, and just it's whatever, and they're just looking into their phones. And I feel like I'm constantly battling against a huge culture about that. And so my war is like, I try to like talk to people on the street, wave to people, kind of open up like a more communal thing. And I was telling you earlier about, so I'm in a nursing program at a university right now, and we're basically like a 40-person family, and everyone's all nervous around each other. They don't know how to act, and I feel like my role is, just because it's my personality trait, I'm so social and so I love talking to everyone, and it's mostly like 20-year-old people. There's different ages too, but mostly 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, 19-year-olds. I'm trying to bridge these gaps between people because I talk to everyone and I find some connection point with everyone. And so one of the battles that I'm waging, let's say, is like upcoming in this next month, I'm like throwing a talent show at my house for all the nursing people. And it's, you know, on the surface, it's a talent show for everyone to go there and show off that they know how to sing, or that one person plays the clarinet, another person plays or sings, or maybe they're gonna show their artwork or something. But it's really just to say, hey, we're like a community. I feel like we're on this ship crossing an ocean against great storms and whatnot, and we need each other. And I think that's a kind of a metaphor for society in general. So I'm constantly trying to create a culture. I realize all of us have the power to create culture on the most local level, whether it's within our friend group, our families, or the people we see in our direct experience, or even if you're an online person who's like on Reddit or whatever, like you can either be shouting people down and telling them how horrible they are, or you can be like uplifting people. And I personally just find it more meaningful to do it in real life. So I'm just trying to, my war is against people. I see this trend of people kind of becoming more individuated. I don't know if that's really a word, but just retiring to their phones and to their own little worlds, and kind of just trying to open that up and battle against all the forces that be in technology and whatnot. And so, yeah, I think I know I have some kind of role to play, and it's my, I feel it as a duty or responsibility because I have this personality trait that's in a sense God-given, because I didn't, I mean, I guess I've been cultivating it, but it's just natural in me to be talking to everyone, and I'm very like in a, I like to be up in front of the class or in front of people and talk. And so things like that, like the talent show, just to pump up people, to support them, to like to create this environment, cultivate this environment in our most localized world that I'm in right now, which is that nursing program.
And why is this a war to you? What is it that makes, I'm not going to say what makes life miserable that it's not that way already, but what is it that you're trying to fight for? What is the pith of the argument that you're trying to state?
I guess what I'm fighting against is kind of going back to the Screwtape Letters, like demon forces, and I just mean that really in a metaphorical sense, and I would say that those are the technology, like social media technologies, that I, in one sense, are connecting us, but really what I see is the more the negative aspect of them, that they're, I see people retiring to them and not knowing how to communicate one-on-one more, and so that would be, I guess, the enemy in a sense, and the pith, or the main point of the thing is, I kind of see us as almost, the humans are kind of like a super organism, and we kind of need each other. We're each other's arms and legs, kind of like a bee or an ant bee colony or an ant colony.
So would part of it be that you're fighting against isolation?
Yeah, definitely. And it seems to be a trend that people are getting more and more isolated, and you know, they're, as technology increases more and more, you can order your food to come be delivered to your house, and you don't have to talk to your neighbors, you don't have to.
If isolation is the enemy, what is your sword?
Love, as generic as that might sound.
No, I think there's more to that. I think, yeah. I think you have other devices. I think you have other weapons. Is it being outspoken? Is it music? Is it talent?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, stories, talking. I think my main thing is, I do music, but I don't think I reach enough people for it to be really my sword. I think what I'm actually out there on the day-to-day battlefield with is just my, just talking. That's just my thing. It comes
natural.
Communication. I just...
Interpersonal communication.
Interpersonal communication. It's just, when I was in high school too, it was the same thing. I would just, I would spend the first 15 minutes, say, of lunch hanging out with my main homies, the cage, the crew, shout out to the Godfathers, but but I would go
shout out Cage.
But I would go out and I would go, okay, today I'm gonna talk to those cheerleader girls or to the that group.
You
of,
do that back then too?
Yeah.
Because you do that now. You were just, when Pork approached me tonight on the way to the liquor store where he bought the Old English he's drinking. By the way, are you getting buzzed at all?
I'm totally buzzed.
Dude, that's a strong beer.
It is. And
yeah. I didn't want to tell
and
you.
I don't drink so often, so I've been buzzed for the last half hour. At
least. Yeah, I know. Me too. So when he approached me on the way to the liquor store, he said, yeah, you know, I went to this, you know, I'm living in this town up in Northern California, and I approached this girl like a long time ago, and then I guess I approached her last night, and we kicked it and stuff like that, and now that he's describing what he did back in high school, I'm seeing a similar pattern And it's cool to see you carry on that integrity that you had back then, but now you're putting a name to it. Now you're putting like a, you're using a methodology in order to attain, in order to bring about a means to complete your mission of developing a community.
Right. And methodology makes it sound like it's a bit contrived, like I'm going to go
That. I don't mean it like that.
Yeah, I didn't think you did, but just to me it's just a natural thing. I just need to get out when I'm just stuck at home. I need to go out and I just find myself doing it. I don't go, I'm going to go talk to a bunch of people, but I just find myself like, today I'm going to talk to the... I am more intentional about it nowadays because I
Watch
see...
Watch, you're completely calculated. It's just sociopathy. I'll just talk to this person saying this thing.
I kind of do. I mean, more... Actually, I've become more and more intentional where in the morning...
Is a methodology. Okay.
I guess it is. Yeah. To a certain extent.
I mean, I don't... You're not rigid. You've never been a rigid person with anything that you do. So I'm not taking it like that. But I'm just saying... that the fact that you do have a method for something it could mean it's a craft that you hone.
Sure, yeah. That's fine. Call it what you will. Methodology, calculated, that's fine.
No, but it's not calculated is a different word. But.
Yeah. But it is true though, I go out and so there's 40 people in my cohort. We're in the same classes, the same for 2.5 years. So to me it's like I envision it in a metaphorical sense as we're boarding this ship and we're crossing an ocean, and it's a tough ocean because we're going through all these trials and tribulations as far as testing and
battling,
know, taking care of patients and tough situations, right, and stuff. And so I feel I could be individual. I can just go man my spot on the ship, like I'm taking care of this furnace that gets the engines going, or I can go and reach out to everyone and kind of lift up everyone to make the ship run better. As an entirety. And so I make it a mission. I go, okay, I haven't really talked to this person that much since I've been in this program. This week, I'm going to make a point to talk to this person who's kind of timid and quiet and sits in the corner, and I'm going to talk to them. And I want to find some connection point. And I can always find a connection. Anyone can find a connection point with someone, with anyone else. I mean, so I do have a kind of a methodology about it. And I feel like that's really my sword, going back to that question, that I find, I don't know, it comes natural to me. I think everyone has their way of doing it, and whether it's they go home and they write something, or they, you know, whatever their talent or their calling may be, I feel like I am fighting against, you know, things that I would call almost vampiric, like TV, or social media, that I know everyone has something about them that wants to create community or to do some kind of good that transcends them, their singular selves.
But why that? Why do you want to wage that war? What would it bring you?
Oh, it definitely lifts me up. It makes my life feel more meaningful. And the alternative is meaninglessness.
But why that?
Why?
Because we all search for meaning. I understand that. Like, I mean, and I guess meaning could be transposed into anything that we want to do. But why does that bring you meaning?
I think it just comes on a visceral level. I feel it. And I guess I could make a logical reason why. Oh, because this person now feels more uplifted and therefore they do this and that thing. I could analyze it maybe, but it's more of a visceral thing in the end. I guess we see someone maybe down, and then you interact with them, and as a result of that interaction, they're more uplifted, and you can see that and feel that.
That sounds like altruism.
Yeah, but I do see it as a selfish thing. It's like, I feel better because of that, but, and I mean, I'm more lifted because they're lifted.
Altruism is also seen as potentially selfish, too. I think all things can be rooted in selfishness to a degree.
Right.
But... I mean, that sounds altruistic in a sense where that's just what it is. But why not something more related to yourself? Why something related towards, like, something external to you?
Well, I can't separate it from myself. I do think it is, in a way, a deeply selfish thing. And by that I mean... a shallowly selfish thing would be to, you know, I often think about it, you know, if you were to steal from people or put other people's down so you could feel better, that would be a selfish thing, but in a shallow sense, because right. you're really just, you know, lifting you up in a temporary way that's not sustainable. But a more deep selfish way would be, you know, lifting others up, or because now I'm intentionally creating a community, and at least I'm making the effort to, in my immediate world that I'm in right now, that I find myself in this town in Northern California with this fellow nursing students, that the more I lift them up, because I know we're in situations where we have to do, for example, I always think of this in my head about it, because we go into these what's called a simulation lab, and we're taking care of fake patients, mannequins that can sweat and can talk back to you, and it's kind of and you go in there and you're by yourself or with another partner, and the whole class is watching you through a video, and so they're watching you to see what mistakes you make and whatnot, and I just know how much it means that if there's a room full of people that love me, I'm gonna do so much better. And if there's a room for people that don't understand me, or that I might have some kind of weird beef with, or even just like not know, it's going to be so much harder for me on an energetic level. So it's in my self-interest to make deep connections with them and to be supportive to them too. And it's kind of an exchange, a mutual exchange we make. So with everything, when I'm speaking in class, when I ask a question, when I bring up things, if I'm in a class where I have a bunch of people that love me because I reached out to them and I helped lift them up, it makes my life so much better.
Well, this is kind of like the commonality that we have between ants and other hive-type...
Superorganisms.
It's called eusocialism. Have you heard that term?
No.
Being eusocial. E-U-S-O-C-I.
Oh, U as in like true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eusocial is when a hive species has the capacity to have standing armies, to have architecture. I mean, even like with hive animals like ants, air conditioning units. I don't mean like electrical air conditioning units, but like ways to cool a hive. And other forms of society that we have as human beings. Eusocialism is the ability to tend after one's own environment and find commonalities and benefit and add benefit from that. And it seems like the war that you wage is also just to maintain community, and that in itself is pretty cool in my eyes.
Yeah, I do. I've had this realization. I think talking about the Antifa people and stuff, or just protesters, I find that people often skip that step and go straight to the very big picture of the whole nation or the whole world.
Yeah.
And they're trying to take
right.
care of that.
Right.
And it's like, I really think
right.
we got to think about those concentric circles. You take care of yourself first. You get
right.
yourself in a whole way. Then you take care of your family and friends. And you make sure things are good with them. Then you go to your community, that people you actually interact with, you make sure that's good. And then once you get those things down and you have a solid foundation, then you move on. And I feel like people skip those steps too often. And it's not that I want to put down people that are organizing for national and global causes, because I think that's so important. I just don't find that in my personality to be that kind of way. And I don't want to put that down, because we need that. But I also think people need to take those steps.
Housekeeping first.
Yeah, housekeeping. And yeah.
I think Kendrick said that his grandma said in one of his songs, if you want to see shit change, you got to wash your ass first.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's true. Like, a lot of times I see, and I don't mean to point the finger at liberal types, because, you know, I try to be somewhat bipartisan. I really want to see the best of both sides, but I'm beginning to see a lot of like hyper-liberal people who have their mind really heavily on ethics for the greater whole, tend to neglect their own personal lives,
mm-hmm.
and they tend to live the most hypocritical, disorganized, just frankly messy lives while they try to uphold an ideal for the rest of society that's completely beyond their grasp. Because you cannot really grasp physically, tangibly, an entire social group when it's only abstract in your mind.
Right.
And yet your own life is a complete mess.
Right.
And so that leads me to the end of this podcast when I say that it's important to be conscious of the war that you engage in. And it's important to embrace community, as evident with what Porat King has revealed to us. So thanks so much for coming on this show tonight, Porat, and thank you for being, thank you for spearheading season 2.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll hope to see you come back in soon. But before we take off, is there any way that the listeners can take a gander at what you've got going on, whether it's any music, any written work, or any photography?
Yeah, I've put most of my stuff up on a website. It's called lotsoflittleworlds.com.
How do you spell that?
Lots of Little Worlds. I'm not going to spell it, but .com. And basically it's just stories, music, some videos I made, and thoughts on things. It's just a blog, but with a multimedia blog.
And before we wrap up, what is that thing that you just showed me earlier today? It's on a newspaper?
Yeah.